This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing from iHeartRadio. My guest today is author Sam Wasson. Whether he's writing about directors such as Blake Edwards, Paul Mazursky, or the history of improv, a consistent theme running through Wasson's books is the perseverance and talent required to make art in Hollywood. His latest book, The Big Goodbye, is about the seminal film Chinatown.
How much are you worth?
I have no idea. How much do you want?
No, I just want to know what you're worth. Over 10 million?
Oh, my, yes.
Why are you doing it? How much better can you eat? What can you buy that you can't already afford?
The future, Mr. Gitz. The future.
This is the love theme from Chinatown by the film's composer, Jerry Goldsmith. In The Big Goodbye, Wasson chronicles the friendships of the four men at the heart of the 1974 classic. Producer Robert Evans, screenwriter Robert Towne, director Roman Polanski, and the movie's star, Jack Nicholson. And what was at stake for each one in making this definitive film? Sam Wasson grew up in Los Angeles and fell in love with the movies early on.
I was a movie lover. It was actually Bullets Over Broadway. I went nuts. I thought, oh, film is not just dialogue and performance. It's a visual component. It's a complete sensual experience. That Bullets was so beautiful and so funny, it knocked me out when I saw it. That was the end. It's the ultimate art form, combining all the other art forms.
You finished film school.
Yeah, USC. First, I went significantly. I went to Wesleyan for film school in Connecticut and studied with Janine Basinger, who's the Hollywood historian on the planet, knows more about Hollywood than anyone ever has, I think, ever will have. And it's just obvious when you talk to her. And she really teaches auteur theory of Hollywood. So I got a deep 4-year long survey of the greatest. And there was no deconstruction. There's no, you know, film theory. It's film as film. And that was my film education. And then I went to USC, which was kind of a bust.
For what?
For film production.
Right. I directed one film myself, and I wouldn't say hated, but I didn't care for it at all. You know, being responsible for cajoling the work out of, especially actors.
It's a lot of managing, isn't it? I mean, it's as much managing as art. Whereas if you're acting or if you're starring or if you're writing, there's very little bullshit that you have to deal with. It's purer, I think.
Well, when I was acting and then I directed a film, I remember that when you make films and you're starring in films, you know, years ago for me, you could be in your trailer and they would knock on the door and say, well, the producer would like to talk to you. Or the head of the studio is here visiting. He'd like to talk to you. And I'd say, tell him I'm asleep. And you could hide in the trailer. As opposed to when you're directing, you can't do that. You can't hide.
No.
You have to, they come to work and they're like, let's talk about how you're over schedule here.
That's an amazing thing about directing is that you're really in reality. You're interfacing with reality all the time. And in other art forms, you can be in your imagination. But when you're making a movie, there's so much shit that you have to do. You're making a building from scratch.
So you finished, you did 4 years at Wesleyan?
Yeah.
And then you wanted more film school?
And then everyone was said, oh, you want to make movies, you got to go to film school, you got to go to USC. And so I thought, oh yeah, USC, of course, that's where, you know, you go to Juilliard if you want to do Lincoln Center, you go to USC if you want to do, you know, Man's Chinese.
So Wesleyan was more film theory and USC was about film production.
Yeah, it was film study. I mean, it was watching movies and talking about filmmaking.
Right. But at what point do you stop and say to yourself, I don't think I'm going to make movies?
Well, I'm not totally convinced that I'm not going to, but at that moment, it was a combination of two things. I looked around and I saw that my fellow classmates were completely invested in the Hobbit thing. And I felt instantly lonely and realized that I was experiencing a microcosm of what it was going to look like out in the real working world. And I thought, you know, maybe the Hollywood that I grew up in is no longer the Hollywood that is, or the Hollywood that I grew up outside of. Mm-hmm. And I was right. And then the book thing just happened.
How?
It was actually Janine Basinger at Wesleyan who said, why don't you write a book? I never thought of it. And I picked Blake because I wanted to pick who I thought was the greatest writer, director of comedy alive, who had not been celebrated.
Now, Blake, my ex-wife, Kim Basinger, did Man Who Loved Women with Blake. And that's when I first met Julie. And, you know, you're so right. I mean, he's so underappreciated. I think Victor Victoria is one of the 10 funniest movies I've ever seen in my life, ever.
I love Victor Victoria. I love 10. I love a movie he made that a lot of people probably don't know about called What Did You Do in the War, Daddy? With Dick Shawn.
Dick Shawn.
And Dick Shawn, I'll just say this. Dick Shawn is a drag scene in the movie. I mean, if I don't know what else you need. But Blake, I always thought that Blake was people look at slapstick somehow, with the exception of Chaplin, who is revered as poetic because he is. Everyone else looks at slapstick as this low form. You know, slapstick is dumb. It's for children. Right. It's childish. And yes. So I think Blake got a bum rap because of that. And I wanted to elevate him and say, this is sophisticated. Someone can fall off a fucking chair and it'd still be Noel Coward. And that's what Victor Victoria is.
Okay. So then you do, after Blake, your next book,
Fifth Avenue, 5 a.m.
Yeah. So Fifth Avenue, 5 a.m. is your next book. Then Mazursky, I think, is after that. Why Mazursky? What did he do to you that made you want to write a whole? Because to write a book, as you know, you're spending a lot of time of your life with that person.
Yeah. Mazursky was just love for the work, enthusiasm for the man, who I'd met a couple of times. And actually, it ties to Blake. As much as I loved the work, Blake left me with such a scar in my heart.
Why? Why?
He personally was so sadistic.
To you?
Yeah. Sadistic to me.
And he was that way to you as his Boswell here?
It was astonishing. I was young. I don't know. You could probably tell me how old I was. I don't remember. I was young. And he would cancel on me, and I'd be in the car on the way over, and he would cancel on me with not giving any reason. And then he would call me up and he would say, you know, get in the car, come on over. And I would get in the car and he would cancel on me. It was a real dance of death. And I finally got in there a couple of times, but it was open hostility.
Jesus Christ.
It was like nothing. Yeah. It was a real abusive, codependent relationship.
So Mazursky is platformed off of Blake. How? Why?
Because we're getting into the therapy portion of the conversation. But of course, I blame myself for the way I was, you know, and I guess I wanted to make sure I knew how to do this and that it wasn't going wrong because of me. And so I wanted to be with someone that I was comfortable with and obviously idolized. And those two things dovetailed perfectly in Paul.
And Mazursky was nothing like Blake, I take it.
Oh, no. Mazursky is, you know, it turns out people are like their movies. Blake Edwards' movies are sadistic and we love them for it. And Paul's movies are loving and warm and we love him for it. But because comedy is finally about rage, to find a nurturing director of comedy, and Nichols would qualify in this case, is a rare thing. And so I'm interested in funny people, and funny people and good people don't always go together. So to find in Mazursky funny and mensch to the core was a beautiful thing, and is what his movies are about.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned Nichols, because Nichols is a very good example. A lot of these big directors I worked with and had very small parts, you know, Stone, Marty, Woody, Nichols. I mean, I didn't have leading roles in these films. And when I worked and I did the movie Working Girl, one of the first films I did, and I worked with Mike, you could tell that Mike was someone who had come through a gauntlet. He'd worked his way. And I don't mean this as a criticism. He had come through a gauntlet where, in the way that you move through the film business and you have, and Polanski reminds me of this as well in your book, Mike was someone who had, in the way that you'll take the good ideas wherever they come from. You'll take the good advice wherever it comes from. And you're going through the jungle, if you will. And eventually you realize that the person you can rely on, the person has that typically, not always maybe, but who typically has the best ideas is yourself. And you grow to rely on yourself, and you don't want anybody to talk you out of what you're keen on.
That's improvising. That's because Mike is an improviser. I mean, right. Does that fit?
Like your, that's, well, that's your other book. That's your other. Now, why did you write that book? Why did you write about improv?
Well, two reasons. One, I do believe it is the great American art form. I do believe that. And the other reason, I wanted to meet Elaine. I wanted to know Elaine. I wanted to celebrate Elaine because she created this. She's a national treasure.
You're referring to Elaine May.
Yes. She is, as you know, tough to get a hold of. I wanted to do it. I didn't do it. And my heart is still not whole. There's still a dark Elaine part in the heart. It belongs to her.
I just worship Elaine. I mean, A New Leaf.
Yep.
Oh, I love Elaine. I love Elaine.
And talk about physical comedy. I mean, that moment where she's taking off the nightgown. I can't remember what it is. And she gets stuck in it. I mean, a woman who could do that and be as spontaneously brilliant as she, it is a, her is, I know.
Author Sam Wasson. If you're as fascinated with old Hollywood as I am, check out my conversation with the legendary Debbie Reynolds and her reflections on the Hollywood studio system.
Most of us, Shirley MacLaine and Elizabeth Taylor, were at MGM, and everything was done for us. You know, the makeup, the hair, they sent cars for us. We were very spoiled. We didn't kind of know what to do when they dropped everybody, like when television came in.
Sure.
And the 48.
Can you remember what year around that was, the end of the 40s?
48, 49.
The studio system kind of died as you get into the 50s?
It slowly died a death, you know. It was, like, interesting to watch. It was, I didn't realize it was the end, you know. I didn't know that it was that.
Hear more of my conversation with Debbie Reynolds at heresthething.org. After the break, Wasson describes what motivated each of the four men behind Chinatown's success. I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. In the movie Chinatown, Jack Nicholson plays Private Eye Jake Gittes, who becomes ensnared in a web of corruption, at the center of which is developer Noah Cross, played by John Huston. It was Noah Cross Sam Wasson was thinking of when he watched the 2016 election results come in.
The moment Trump won, I turned to my friend Graham and I said, what's the story now? What movie are we living in? And that was it. Combined with the fact that, of course, I'm angry about what's happened to Hollywood. And so I'm always looking for ways to scream and to tell this story about the nightmare that has become of America, which was the story we were just beginning to live at that point 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. Combined with its position in the decline of that second great wave of the new Hollywood, and the four personalities who are fascinating, you know, in and of themselves.
But that's what I want to break that down, those four, because for me, when I read what you said about Trump and Noah Cross, I thought, well, Noah Cross to me was more, even though he's a fictional character, he was more Robert Moses than Donald Trump. You know, I mean, he actually accomplished things. He was diabolical and he was very, very Machiavellian, but he accomplished things as opposed to Trump, who's accomplished only, you know, genocide.
That's right. Yeah.
When I read the book and I put everything through the prism of the book and understanding the film through your lens, what I came away with, and you correct me here or help me, is there's four men that come together. Robert Evans is the head of Paramount. Nicholson is the film star, really ascending at this point in his career. Polanski does Rosemary's Baby. Then his wife is killed right after that. He makes a movie right on the heels of his wife being murdered. And then Robert Towne, the screenwriter, and all four of them come together. And I guess it's safe to say this is a bit of an obvious thing. Four guys come together, all of whom have an equivalent level of desperation for this movie mm-hmm. to work. They all mm-hmm. are obsessed with making this work. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Right.
Describe for me with the relationship between, you spend a good amount of time in the book, and the relationship between Towne and Polanski. So the film of Chinatown, the shooting script, the scenes that were shot, and I'm assuming that eventually a script is compiled and it is bound, if you will, that is the shooting script. Is that more Polanski than Towne?
Well, Towne obviously generated it. And then Polanski, for years, he was generating it. And Towne is a very slow writer and a very expansive writer. I mean, he writes big and then struggles to cut down, to structure. So when Polanski comes in the last 2 or so weeks or a month or whatever it was, Polanski really structures it. So I guess the answer is yes. So the structure is Roman, no question about it. But the material is Town.
Now, Town, who had his writing partner, Edward Taylor.
Yeah.
And Taylor was someone, describe that relationship. Taylor was someone who did a lot of work, uncredited. I think nearly all of it uncredited. Was he ever credited? Did you mention that in the book? Did he get a credit anywhere?
Not on a Town movie. He got a credit, a writing credit on a movie called W.I. Warshawski, Kathleen Turner picture.
Yes, 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 yes.
Edward Taylor got credited for that, but he never got a writing credit on a Robert Town movie. Never wanted one.
Why do you think that is when you have a guy, here's four men who are fairly, if not obsessed with success, they're obsessed with greatness, their legacy. I mean, you could fine tune all four men. What did they had something in common, but it was a little bit distinctive what Nicholson wanted, Evan, so forth. But for Taylor to be in the rooms with these people and writing these seminal films, why do you think he didn't want any credit? What was it about?
Well, there's stated reasons and then there's unstated reasons. And the stated reasons were, and this is Taylor, either from his own writing or from or what he told to other people, were, one, he didn't want to deal with the bullshit of show business. He just wanted to punch in, punch out, write the scenes, do the creative work, and not have to deal with the haggling of the negotiations and egos and despair and all that stuff that comes with having your name on something. There's a certain amount of freedom that you get to say, no one's going to know that I was here. So there was that. Then there was the long-term friendship that he had with Town going all the way back to their years at Pomona when they were in college. Mm-hmm. So he felt a kind of loyalty to Town, which manifested as subordinating himself to Town's, you know, quite obvious need to be a star. And then there were all these speculative secret reasons about secrets that they might have had on each other. Then there was, of course, Edward's alcoholism and Town really being a support to Taylor, you know, because Taylor got paid for this. And Taylor in his heart really did believe, you know, these are Town's movies, which they were insofar as Town generated them. And I'm just helping Robert with his movie.
He convinced himself of that.
Yeah.
That it really was more Town. And also there are people like that who what they convince, and they have a certain kind of personality. I've known a couple myself where their attitude is better the crumbs off your table than nothing at all.
That's it. That's it. So there's deep pathological stuff that we can't even get into, but that's the type that you're describing.
But the one thing that you see in this movie is the death of that studio executive like Evans. You mention a piece of very well-known history, the advent of Jaws and what Jaws does to marketing and films and how the business all changes in the wake of that. But you tell it so well. I mean, you tell it really wonderfully. You make everybody really see the impact this had. Once these guys knew there was big money in them, their hills, everything changes. What was it about Evans that he wanted to have great films that made money and won awards?
He loved it. He loved it. He loved show business. He loved movies. He loved people. He loved talent. It's actually that simple. I asked him this question. I said, Evans, is it as simple as you bet on talent? Do you have an easy job? And he said, you're goddamn right. That was, and it's true. I mean, if you have the courage, that's the question. Do you have the courage to say, yes, I believe you are talented, here's the check, then you're a great studio executive. Because even if the movie fails, even if it is a steaming piece of shit humiliation to everyone on the planet, at least you go to bed thinking, I picked a good guy. I picked the right people to do that.
Right, right.
That's a pride that what executive can now go to sleep saying that?
You know, the Evanses, and you mentioned Zanuck and people like that who were running the studios back then, some of them were people who knew how to make movies, but they knew people who knew how to make movies, and they knew how to bring them together and seduce them into coming in to join them on this venture.
Yes. I mean, Goldman's maxim turns out to be right. I believe nobody does know anything.
Right.
I believe nobody knows anything. Those people who end up being the most successful are the people who have the who are the strongest to adhere to their great taste. Mm-hmm. And those guys, Zanuck, all those great guys, had exactly that.
Now, Evans, of course, you do a wonderful job in the book. This is a prism through which you learn a lot about the movie business and the history of the movie business. It's a great, great, great book. And you also learn what a seminal year this is in 1974. So many great movies made. And Evans is someone who, you know, is that white hot period in the 70s. The studios are making Paint Your Wagon and Finian's mm-hmm. Rainbow. Mm-hmm. And all that stuff is tanking. And then along comes, and Robert Osborne said this to me when we co-hosted TCM together. He said, you know, I just hate Easy Rider. Because Easy Rider is the movie that comes along and just changes everything.
Yeah.
The movies
yeah.
become so real and so ugly and so uh-huh. And so nasty. And so and they're like documentaries. Nicholson becomes a star, if you will, on the back of that movie in 69. Then we get into the 70s, and what happens?
Well, you know, just like Hollywood being Hollywood, Easy Rider is a hit, so then they all fall over themselves trying to get the next one. Now, unlike today, where they fall over themselves trying to get the next one, back then, making a movie was relatively inexpensive enough mm-hmm. that they could understand the next one being, well, let's try another little movie based on a, you know, based on a couple of guys. You know, the modesty of the Easy Rider project could be replicated. And that is a recipe for creativity. And so that's what they did after that. Absolutely cynical undertaking insofar as Hollywood is doing what it's always done. But because the economics of the system are conducive to creativity, and the people calling the shots are genuinely interested in art, it can flower.
Polanski's wife, he makes the movie Rosemary's Baby, which I can't say enough about that movie. And the more I watch that movie, that's one of the ones I've downloaded on my computer because of that remarkable balance he has. You have Ruth Gordon in this, like right up to the, her toes are right on the line of camp in that
movie. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And yet there's Sidney Blackmer playing her husband, yep. who's as velvety. And the cast is Alicia Cook. You have the creepy and the sour and the sweet and the weird and the pleasant yeah. and the, everything yeah. in harmony. And the same is true for this movie. The same is true. Polanski is a master of casting.
Master. I'm so glad you brought definitely down to, I mean, who is Burt Young in Chinatown? Talk about juicy. I mean, it's an embarrassment of riches that we never get. The movie is so fertile in talent that we never get down to the Burt Young of it all.
We obscure Burt Young.
Yeah, we do obscure Burt Young. Diane Ladd. How about that?
Dead on the floor.
Oh, and just a perfect, perfect portrait of a nervous actress all the way through, performing down to the very end when he pulls out the SAG card. And that is an L. That is also inside. That's a little gift to an Angelino to see that. Oh, yes, she was an actress. Of course she was. And you play it back in your mind. And the whole psychology of the actress just kind of harmonizes with what you've seen. Fucking Polanski casting that movie. I mean, how do you teach the ability to cast? That has to be one of the things like you have it or you don't.
It's a gift you have to have. You have to sense that that person can do, even if you have to push them, even if they have to dig down. You know, Gary Oldman became a star doing Sid and Nancy. Gary Oldman became a star doing Sid and Nancy and won an Oscar playing Churchill.
Yeah.
Talk about that journey as an actor in terms of the disposition of the character. Now, Polanski, his wife is killed. He does Rosemary's Baby. It's released in 68. His wife is killed in 69. He comes and does this movie, I guess, in 73. It's released in 74, correct?
Yeah.
And what Polanski is showing up now to shoot Chinatown, which Polanski shows up now? He's changed how from the horrors of what happened to his wife?
He's been devastated. He's been devastated, and he left town. And it should be said, not just because his wife and child and friends were murdered by the men, not just because of the emotional residue of the grief, but because the town turned on him in a way. The town, in the panic around figuring out who the killer was, we didn't know who the killer was. Mm-hmm. there was speculation that, well, maybe it's Polanski.
Right,
his
right.
movies are
people don't
evil
know that.
Enough.
I learned that from you. I learned that from your book.
And it's a tribute to his friends, Dick Silbert, Jack, Warren Beatty, Evans, the people who were really his friends who stuck by him and supported him in that. I mean, the grief, to compound on top of the grief, the paranoia of the town closing in on you, I can't even make a word to come out of that.
Well, they put him back together again, so to speak, his friends.
They put him back together
again. He's got a good bunch of friends.
And that's kind of also what this book is about secretly for me, is a good bunch of friends, because that's what I dream of. That's what a good Hollywood should feel like.
One thing that was just really assaulted me from the book was that idea that back then, and it never crossed my mind, it never occurred to me that Polanski was someone who people, he was a suspect in some people's minds.
He was a suspect.
And now the whole town, the whole community lived in terror in the wake of
Lived in terror. And I should add, to compound, to make this even fucking worse, he didn't know who the killer was. So he's suspecting his friends. Maybe it is Warren.
Yes.
Maybe it is Warren.
He's trying to get sample D. What was he trying to get? Like blood samples off of steering wheels and the carpeting of cars and all this shit.
Yes.
That's an amazing part of the book.
I mean, it's enough for an opera right there. I mean, people say it's a Greek tragedy. I mean, Roman Polanski, that's to say nothing of what we all know is coming, but just that incident right there, unimaginable.
Author Sam Wasson. If you're enjoying this conversation, tell a friend and be sure to subscribe to Here's the Thing on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. When we come back, Wasson talks about the reception of the film's shocking ending and its remarkable score. I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Because Chinatown was Jack Nicholson's first real turn as a leading man, he paid attention to every last detail, down to his wardrobe, to inhabit Jake Gittes.
I mean, it was deep in him, too, because town wrote it for him. Town observed Nicholson. They were in Jeff Corey's acting class.
Right.
And improvised. Improvisation was heavy in that class. And so Jack is a great improviser. So Town really became a master of Jack, whatever that means. And so learned how to just hit it right to him.
Sometimes I think the guy that can nail Chinatown, and especially that ending and that last line. The guy that can nail that ending, you write with great detail and great insight into the shooting of that final scene and the car driving off in that long shot and the actor that pulls the gun and shoots her, you know, the whole kind of existential ennui of the whole thing at the end. Forget about it, Jake, it's Chinatown. I thought to myself, that's Polanski in the wake of his wife being butchered that way.
Yes.
Like his mother's killed. His father says to him, you have it in there. Move it. Move it. The prompt from the father, but you just keep moving. Just keep moving. And Polanski was certainly primed to nail it because of all the horrors he'd been through.
And it's hard to imagine a more horrific ending to a major Hollywood movie. It's hard to imagine.
And when the film was screened for the executives, what was their, you write about this, what was their response to the film?
You know, you tried your best, Evans, you know. Sue Mengers was like, honey, what were you thinking? I can't do Sue. You could do it, you know. Right. They're filing out in the Directors Guild. Was it Freddie Fields who had a sort of shit-eating grin on his, Freddie and Evans were never simpatico.
Right.
But then it got good reviews.
Yeah, then it did well. It did well and won a lot of awards.
Yeah.
Jack didn't win.
Who won that year? Oh, Art Carney.
From
Mazursky. From Mazursky. Even Mazursky knew
Mazursky
when I talked to him.
Snatches Jack's Oscar and hands it, not so fast, Jack, and hands it to Art Carney.
Yeah. I think even Paul was a little embarrassed of that.
Was it Going in Style?
No, it was Harry and Tonto.
And Tonto.
Uh-huh.
Let's see, Chinatown, Harry and Tonto. Let's see. Wow. Okay. No, I love
that. That sounds like an SCTV sketch from the makers of Chinatown.
From the makers of Chinatown.
Here comes a story of a man and his cat.
You know, one of the things that I love the part of the story because I'm obsessed with musical score. Describe how there was the path with the score for Chinatown. One composer who then, what happens?
His name was Philip Lambro, and he wrote, I don't have the language to even describe what music. I mean, you can actually find the score on YouTube, and it was an atonal, edgy, expressionistic, weird, you know, not melodic, not what you think of as Hollywood, certainly not what you think of as 40s glamour Hollywood. And it didn't work. And this was like in the final moments before, right. You know, scoring comes in at the very
happened?
End. And what happened was Evans called Goldsmith and said, "You got to save my life." And Goldsmith said, "All right." And 10 days later, and 10 days sounds like a legend, you know, sounds like fable fiction stuff. I got 10 days confirmed all over the place. It really was 10 days. I mean, if it wasn't 10, it was 11 days. You know, he turned around a masterpiece in no time.
This is another reason why Evans is Evans. Only people like Evans can pick up the phone and get somebody like Goldsmith to write a score for one of the greatest movies in the world in 10 to 11 days or whatever the fuck it is.
And it also tells you that Evans was beloved on a personal level.
Yes.
You know?
He could make those calls.
And you make those calls and someone says yes and turns it around and Evans supervised the score. You know, music was so important to Evans. So important to Evans, even though he fucked up on Godfather by not, you know, Nino Rota pushing back on. It's okay. But Evans loves music because he's finally in his heart just a romantic and a softie. And also music is a major part of post-production. And that's where Evans can come in and get his hands in there. Sometimes he gets his hands a little too much in there as Coppola knows and suffered by. But that's the shadow side of Evans. But music allowed him to do that.
Obviously, many people know this already, that your book has been optioned and they're going to make a movie out of it. And my dear friend Lorne Michaels is going to produce. And then in addition to Lorne as producer, Ben Affleck has been collared, if you will, to do the directing. What is something you are hopeful about?
I'm hopeful that they'll do right by Roman.
In what regard?
Well, you know, the times that we're living in, you know, surely I'm surprised they even did it, you know, that they thought that this would be the right climate to make a movie that stars the character Roman Polanski and is a, I should dare say, because I wrote it, a sympathetic portrait in the book. Mm-hmm. Balanced, I hope, but sympathetic. And we live in such extreme, I don't know, we live in such an extreme yes or no.
Yeah, cancel culture.
Cancel culture, this or that, there is no gray area, and Roman is the definition of gray, and every great character is. Every great character is. So I want to see not just them to do right by Roman because I know him and respect him, but also I want the movie to be as good as it could be, and my theory is that to write a character who lives in the gray, I wish that for every character in the movie, that they're in the gray. And I wish that for every character in every movie.
Author Sam Wasson on his book, The Big Goodbye, Chinatown and the Last Years of Hollywood. I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. We're produced by Kathleen Russo, Kerry Donahue, and Zach McNeese. Our engineer is Frank Imperial. Thanks for listening.